Well, I would like to say that I'm humbled and honored to be here, and thanks for your prayers as we prepared and traveled. And I want to thank you for giving me a travel day yesterday. Gordon Almstutz married my niece, and he worked for us for several years, and he's my co-pastor. And I thought it would be rude not to go to his father's funeral events. And so I'm indebted to you all for letting us start tonight. Some of you all remember Rachel High Bang. She's a little sweetheart. I had her as a Bible school student, and here she lives in our area. But she was going to bring Grace for the weekend, and because we came to the funeral, Grace came with me, and she'll go home tomorrow morning with some of Gordon's children. But I think maybe Rachel's coming anyway, so you may be surprised. I want to have something each evening for the children. I grew up when revival meetings were 2 weeks, and then there was the George Brunk tent meetings, and they were 6 weeks, and Vacation Bible School was 2 weeks. Boy, we didn't fool around back then. We went to church. But benches do get hard for children. I want you to want to be here. And so I'm going to tell you something for you to memorize. And then tomorrow evening, I want you all to say it to me. Now, I went to church in the old bank church. Now, some of y'all don't know what the bank church is, but most of you do. Well, we went to the old one. And there was a man came one evening from Oregon. His name was Marcus Lynn. And he was a Bible scholar. He wrote a commentary on the book of Romans. And good luck if you want to find one. They're about $90 or $100. And the family won't let it be reprinted for some reason. I'm not sure. But it's kind of the gold standard on Romans commentary, in my opinion. But I remember him, and we was all a bunch of little boys and girls sitting on the front benches. And he told about his dad. He went to town and bought a new suit coat. And, you know, your suit coat's got this pocket that's worthless. I don't know what it's here for. But in that pocket, somebody had engraved, before he bought it, these words: "What good will it do to smoke and to chew, to swear and to drink, and never to think what the end may be?" And temptations have changed. Smoking was a big thing in the 50s and 60s. But, you know, it's not cool to smoke anymore. Only losers smoke. Well, you all have new temptations, and we'll talk about those, maybe some. But the gist of the proverb is still the same. You need to make good choices as children so vice doesn't become a part of your life and become difficult when you become older and want to be a Christian and walk with Jesus. So I'm going to say it one more time, and then you're going to say it with me. And so I'm going to ask for somebody to say it tomorrow night. And I don't know your names yet, but I'll point to you. I'm not afraid to do that. What good will it do to smoke and to chew, to swear and to drink, and never to think what the end may be? All right, let's all say it together. What good will it do to smoke and to chew, to swear and to drink, and never to think what the end may be? Now, maybe some of your mothers wrote that down on a piece of paper for you, but that's okay if she didn't. I come to you this evening as a sinner saved by grace. A broken man. I used to go to revival meetings, and revival meetings as a teenager and as a young boy, and I told you that. And these men would get up and they would talk about these lofty Christian ideals and principles. They walked on water, it seemed, and I just couldn't relate because I was a struggling teenager, and I just couldn't relate to these guys that were so perfect. The Christian life just worked out for them, and it wasn't working for me. And so this evening, I'm just going to be open and honest with you, and I want you to be open and honest with God. And that's how I will approach these meetings. I can't help but carry a heavy load this evening coming to you soon after the death of our brother. What I have entitled my message this evening is, Where is God when pain, suffering, and the death angel comes to my house? In Romans 8:28, how's that working out for you? I want to dedicate the content of my message that I feel God wants me to share with you this evening to those of you who are hurting from the rough paths with jagged edges that we sometimes feel as we walk the trails of life's experiences. For those who suffer daily from crippling challenges of mental illness, the young couple who may be devastated from infertility when their peers seem to have a new baby every year. For those who have buried children or a spouse so prematurely as we see it. Where is God when it seems that the very Son of Life itself has gone down behind the mountain and its warm and bright rays seem extinguished forever? Some years ago, Grace and I were asked to go to Pennsylvania to a death and grieving seminar. I had to have a part there, and of course we had to go because we had experienced it. I didn't want to go up there and sit there in that room for a weekend with all of those grieving people and listen to their stories, sharing their pain afresh. But when we left, I was humbled. I was honored. And we could never be the same. William Sloan Coffin was the chaplain at Yale University, and he had a son killed in a car accident. And when his son was killed at the funeral, the minister in charge made some feeble attempt and made a statement about the boy's accident being God's will. But before the man could finish, Mr. Coffin, he stood up and yelled at the preacher, That's not so. When my son died, God was the first one who cried. And so I ask, where is God when these things happen to us? Martin Luther also lost a son, and when his wife Katie shouted at him, Where was God when our son died? Martin Luther answered, The same place he was when his son died. He was there watching and weeping. I want to read a poem. I walked a mile with pleasure. I walked a mile with pleasure. She chattered all the way, but left me none the wiser for all she had to say. I walked a mile with sorrow, and ne'er a word said she, but oh, the things I learned from her. Oh, the things that I learned from her when sorrow walked with me. I knew Brother Keith Crider, but I didn't know him closely, as most of you, his fellow parishioners, and of course his family did. I remember seeing Keith as a young teen running the till at Valley Books for Arlen Snyder sometime before we moved to South Carolina in 1973. Keith helped in an ordination at one of our churches more recently, and I had the honor of helping Nellie and Johnny Screeveseth off to a happy life together. I preached, and Keith took care of the vows. I read the Cry of the Northland books written by Miss Virginia Crider as an adolescent or a young teen, and it planted the seeds in my heart that later called me to Northwestern Ontario in 1977, and to work there with what was then called Northern Light Gospel Mission. I was there for 7 years, and while it was not a financial success, it forever changed the trajectory of my life and helped me to prepare to become the God man that God wanted me to be. And God, in his own benevolent way, gave me a lovely Canadian wife, Grace. A Road Not Chosen, by James Pence. Unlike most expectant fathers, I did not look forward to the sonogram. I dreaded it. And from the moment Laurel and I walked through the doors of the specialist's office, an uneasy feeling crept into my stomach, and the two-hour wait did not ease my fears. And now the doctor's unwillingness to discuss his findings only intensified my anguish. I would have given anything to be anywhere else that day. How different that sonogram was from the first one. Only 2 weeks early, we were overflowed with joy. We anticipated the brief look at our first child, and we drove to the doctor's office, and we was hardly conceal our excitement. And in the darkened examining room, lit only by the cool, bright light of a monitor, the obstetrician pointed out the little hands and feet on the screen. We smiled at each other when he told us that we were going to have a little girl. And then as the doctor examined every detail of our baby's body, I noticed something. I saw what appeared to be a small bump on the baby's head. The doctor didn't mention it at first, but he had seen it too. "It's probably nothing," he said later, "but I'd let you get a high-resolution sonogram anyway. 9 times out of 10, these things don't amount to anything. Don't worry about it." Despite his reassuring words, we left his office. The eagerness of new parents had been evaporated, and only a gnawing fear remained. Perhaps that perfect child we prayed for would not be so perfect after all. And it's funny how circumstances change your perspective. Before the sonogram, when one would ask us if we wanted a boy or a girl, we'd say, "Oh, it don't matter. All we want is a healthy baby." And we didn't think about it too much to ask. But over the 2 weeks between the first and the second sonograms, a transition began to take place. I entered into that period hoping for a perfect child, and now I had to deal with the possibility that our baby might have some kind of a handicap. We returned home and tried to resume some sort of routine. I went to church and spread out my commentaries and prepared to study for a Sunday message. I stared at those pages for hours, seeing words and comprehending nothing. And then the church phone rang, and it was Laurel. And I could tell that she'd been crying. "What's wrong?" I asked. "Did the doctor call?" "Yes," she said. "Y'all right?" "Not really. I'll be right home." And I drove home like an ambulance driver on call, and I burst through the front door to find Laurel sitting on the couch with a box of tissue papers. The news was bad. "The baby gonna die," she said. "There's something wrong with her brain, and the doctor says she probably won't live but a few hours." And later we learned that a genetic flaw had caused multiple birth defects, one of which that the baby's brain had not developed properly. I sat down beside my wife and melted into tears. I wasn't ready for this. I had prepared myself for every eventuality but the worst. And then the reality sank in quickly. Not only would our baby die, but for the next 16 weeks, Laura would carry a child who had no chance of surviving. And then the questions flooding in. How could this happen? How could we face the loss of a child and still glorify God? How could I pastor a church and tell God's people of his goodness when I wasn't even sure of it myself anymore? Joining hands, we approached his presence, and through my tears I prayed, Lord, you've asked us to walk this road. Now please give us the grace to do it. Please get us through this. For the next 4 months, we tried to forget the unforgettable. And although we had committed our way to the Lord, we still struggled. We struggled with all the well-meaning strangers approaching us and asking us what our baby's name was. Grief stabbed our hearts every time the baby moved or kicked. And we had to continue our childbirth classes preparing for a new life that would never be. And we felt the sting of well-intentioned but thoughtless statements like, oh, you're young, you'll have another baby. And we endured the dull ache of a grief process that we could not close. Then the night came when Laurel had felt the first contractions. And at the hospital the next morning, we were ushered into a labor room and began the long wait. And while we waited, we realized that we had never chosen a name for our daughter, so we decided to call her Michelle Lynn. When she was born at 7 p.m. on a Monday, we could only steal a brief glimpse of our baby as the nurses rushed her into the neonatal ICU. Later, we visited her, and she looked like a child's doll with a little body dwarfed by the equipment surrounding her. We made frequent visits to ICU those first days, holding Michelle, treasuring her, and then we'd return to Laurel's room, wondering if we would ever hold her again. And every time the phone rang, I held my breath. But the dreaded news still did not come. Michelle showed no signs of weakening. After 2 days, Laurel said, I'd like to take her home. The idea was incredible, but I agreed. The doctor supported us and made arrangements for home health service. And on Thursday afternoon, a caravan of cars left the hospital. Michelle was coming home. She required 24-hour care, and since she was unable to regulate her own body temperature, we kept her wrapped in blankets. An intravenous drip provided the fluids that she could take on her own, couldn't take on her own. Laurel's parents stayed with us, and we each took our shifts caring for Michelle, holding and rocking a heavily blanketed baby in the sweltering June heat. For 4 days, we held, we cared for, and we cuddled this little child who couldn't even respond to us. Her eyes never opened except for a startled reflex at the flash of a camera. She never cried. She never made a sound except for a whimper when we changed her diaper. Soon, our home version of ICU became routine. Friends from our church brought food and encouragement. Daily visits from the home health nurse brought supplies and technical assistance. Muriel's mother, also a nurse, added a touch of both grandmotherly and professional care. But in the midst of the activity, I still felt a sense of dread. I was glad to have Michelle home, but I dreaded what I knew was coming. I didn't know how soon, but I knew she would die. What would it be like? I didn't know what to expect, and I was afraid. I feared being there. I almost feared not being there. Lord, give me the grace to face the moment, I prayed. That moment came on Monday, 1 week after she had been born, and Michelle's IV had infiltrated, and the home health care nurse came to our house to restart it. We laid Michelle on the dining room table and gave the nurse a better working spot. Place. She started the IV and then went on to her other patients. And while Laurel's mother prepared lunch, we decided to keep Michelle on the table near us. And for the first time in 4 days since we brought her home, Michelle's parents sat together holding her hands. Then as the clatter of the dishes colored the background, Michelle quickly stopped breathing. I took Laurel's hand, drawing her away from the conversation. I think she's gone. I said, my voice was breaking. Laurel looked at her and then looked back at me and nodded. The flood of tears that I held back for 4 months finally came. It was over. And I heard the voice of my father-in-law in the background offering a halting prayer of thanksgiving. Michelle had gone home. How could I glorify God after losing a child? And how could I tell God's people about His goodness? I can tell about God's grace is always sufficient for us, even in the hardest times, but how can I praise Him from orchestrating the moment of Michelle's death, so that both Laurel and I could be with her, holding her hands? I can glorify Him for the countless doors of ministry He opened for that time, allowing us to encourage others who are going through similar experiences. And I can thank Him for the 7 unforgettable days and unforgettable baby. I can worship Him because He truly is in control. And in spite of the bad things that happen to us, God can use it for our good and for His honor and glory. Every day, we choose one of the attitudes of life amid life's difficulties, to be beat up or to be upbeat. To say with Jacob in Genesis 42, all these things are against me. Or to say with Paul in Romans 8:28, that all things are working together for good to those who love God. There's 3 verses that I want to look at briefly. You don't need to look them up. I'll just read them to you. First one, James chapter 1, 2 and 4, 2 through 4. Consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance, and perseverance must finish its work so that you can mature and complete, nothing lacking. 1 Peter 4:12. But rejoice that you participate in the sufferings of Christ, so that you may be overjoyed with His glory is revealed. And if you are insulted because of the name of Christ, you are blessed, for the Spirit and glory of God rests on you. And then 1 Peter 1:6 and 7. In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while you have had to suffer grief and all kinds of trials. These have come so that your faith of greater worth than gold, which perishes even though refined by fire, may be proved genuine and may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed. All of us experience pain from time to time in our lives. There can be physical pain, the result of an injury to our body. There can be emotional pain, the result of things either from a chemical imbalance or the processes of mind that grind us down and the soul becomes full of despair and hopelessness. In fact, it was with pain that each of us arrived into this world. William Blake put it this way, "My mother groaned, my father wept, and into the dangerous world I leapt." Is physical pain more difficult than emotional pain? Is pain that I bear more difficult or burdensome than yours? And where is a loving God when children suffer from a lack of love, abusive homes, or those born with deformed and twisted little bodies, only to be racked with pain all of their lives, one hopeless day after one hopeless day? How do you cope with the pain in your life? Do you see it as a result of not measuring up or God's discipline and chastening in your life? Do you live with it cheerfully? Or do you try to spread the gloom and misery around? Someone has said that it's easier to suffer in silence if you're sure somebody is watching. Yes, misery does love company. I am somewhat reluctant to address this subject. Grace, my grace, and women in general are much better at this. Childbirth, shingles, and many other things. I'm not a champion for great pain. And as we look at this subject this evening, I hope that we can see the care and compassion of a loving Christ as He Himself meets the needs of hurting and pain-ridden people, not only in His ministry on earth, but as He works in the hearts and lives of hurting and needy people today. I want to read you about Claudia Claxton. I feel helpless around people in great pain, helpless and also guilty. I stand beside them watching facial features contorting and listening to sighs and moans, deeply aware of the huge gulf between us. I cannot penetrate their suffering. I can only watch. Whatever I attempt to say seems weak and stiff, as if I've memorized the lines from some school play. One day I received a frantic plea for help from a close friend, John and Claudia Claxton. Newlyweds in their early 20s, they had just begun life together in the Midwest, and I watched in amazement as they experienced the romantic love utterly transformed John Claxton. 2 years of engagement to Claudia had melted his stony heart and cynicism and softened his hard edges. He became an optimist, and now his letters to me were unusually bubbly and with enthusiasm about his young marriage. But one letter from John alarmed me as soon as I opened it. There was errors and scratch-throughs marred his unusually neat handwriting. And he explained, "Excuse my writing. I guess it shows up how I'm fumbling for words. I don't know what to say." The Claxton's young marriage had run into a roadblock far bigger than any of them. Claudia had been diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease, a cancer of the lymph glands, and was given only a 50% chance to live. Within a few weeks, surgeons had cut her from armpit to belly, removing every visible trace of the disease, and she was left stunned and weak and laying on a hospital bed. At the time, ironically, John was working as chaplain's assistant in the local hospital. His compassion for other patients dipped dangerously. In some ways, he told me, I could understand better what other patients were going through. But I didn't care anymore. All I cared about was Claudia. I wanted to yell at them, "Stop your sniveling, you idiots. You think you've got problems. My wife is dying right now." Chemotherapy treatments took their toll on Claudia's body. Beauty fled her almost overnight. She felt and looked weary. Her skin darkened, her hair fell out, her throat was raw, and she regurgitated nearly everything she ate. The doctors had to suspend treatment for a time when her throat was so swollen she could not make swallowing motions any longer. When the radiation treatments resumed, she was periodically laid out flat on a table, naked. She could do nothing but lie still and listen to the whir and click of machinery as it bombarded her with invisible particles, each dose aging her body by months. And as she lay in that chill, still room, Claudia would think about God and about her suffering. Claudia had hoped that Christian visitors would comfort her by bringing some perspective on what she was going through. But their voices proved confusing, not consoling. The deacon from their church solemnly advised her to reflect on what God was trying to teach her. "Surely, something in your life must displease God," he said. "Somewhere you must have stepped out of His will. These things don't just happen. God uses circumstances to warn us and to punish us. What is He telling you?" A few days later, Claudia was surprised to see a woman from church who she barely knew. Evidently, this plump, scatterbrained widow had adopted the role of professional cheerleader to the sick. She brought flowers, she sang hymns, she stayed long enough to read some happy psalms about brooks and mountains, clapping their hands. And whenever Claudia tried to talk about her illness or prognosis, the woman quickly changed the subject, trying to combat the suffering with cheer and goodwill. But she only visited once, And after a while, the flowers faded, the hymns seemed out of place, and Claudia was left to face a new day of pain. Another woman dropped by, a fellow follower of big-name faith healers. Exuding confidence, she assured Claudia that healing was her only escape. And when Claudia told her about the deacon's advice, the woman nearly exploded. "Sickness is never God's will," she exclaimed. "Haven't you read the Bible? The devil stalks us like a roaring lion, but God will deliver you if you can muster up enough faith to believe you'll be healed. Remember, Claudia, faith can move mountains, and that includes Hodgkin's disease. Simply name the promise in faith and then claim the victory." The next few mornings, as Claudia lay in her sterile treatment room, she tried to muster up the faith. She wondered if she ever understood the procedure. She did not question God's supernatural power, but now to go on convincing God of her sincerity. Faith wasn't like muscle that could be enlarged through rehabilitation and exercise. It was slippery and intangible, impossible to grasp. The whole notion of mustering up faith seemed awfully exhausting, and she could never decide what it really meant. Perhaps the most spiritual woman in Claudia's church came along with some books about praising God for everything that happens. "Claudia, you need to come to the place where you can say, 'God, I love you for making me suffer like this. It is your will, and you know what's best for me. I praise you for loving me enough to allow me to experience this. In all things, including this, I give thanks.' Like God is treating you so much better than you deserve." As Claudia pondered the words, her mind filled with rather grotesque image of God. She envisioned a figure in the shape of a troll, big as the universe, who took delight in squeezing helpless human beings between his fingertips, pulverizing them with his fists, and dashing them against sharp stones. The figure would torture these humans until they cried out, "God, I love you for doing this to me." The idea repulsed Claudia, and she decided she could not love or worship such a God. Another visitor came, Claudia's pastor. He made her feel that she was on a select mission. He said, "Claudia, you have been appointed to suffer for Christ, and he will reward you. God chose you because of your great strength and integrity, just as he chose Job, and he is using you as an example to others. Their faith may increase because of your response. You should feel privileged, not bitter. What we see as adversity, God sees as opportunity." He told her to think of herself as a track star, and to view adversity as a series of hurdles that she would need to leap over on her way to victory circle. Sometimes the notion of being a privileged martyr applauded to Claudia, a self-pitying sort of way. Other times, when the pain crescendoed, she vomited up food and her facial figures aged, Claudia would call out, "God, why me? There are millions of Christians stronger and more honorable than I. Why couldn't you choose one of them instead?" She didn't feel like a track star at all, and she wondered why God would deliberately place the hurdles in the path of someone he loved. I too visited Claudia and found her desperately confused by all these contradictory words, and she repeated for me the advice given by her well-meaning Christians, and I listened to her bewildered response. Which of these was she supposed to be learning? And how could she have more faith? Who should she listen to? In the midst of all this confusion, Claudia had one certainty. Her happy world with John was disintegrating. And above all, she didn't want it to end. I had little advice for Claudia that day. In fact, I came away with even more questions. Why was she laying in a hospital bed when I stood there beside her healthy? Something inside of me recoiled as I heard her repeat the cliched comments of her visitors. Is Christianity supposed to make a sufferer feel worse? All of these people repeated their own versions of oftentimes conflicting voices from Christian comforters. One amputee told me, "My religious friends were the most depressing. They were the most irritating part of my whole experience. That pattern disturbed me greatly. Something was wrong. A faith founded on the great physician should bring peace, not comfort at a time of trials." And I want to add a footnote that Claudia's cancer was healed and it never returned. So what is the purpose of pain in our lives? We have physical pain, we have many kinds. But physical pain acts like a warning system. When something hurts, it forces us and our attention to concentrate to that area of our bodies to give it help, to help meet its needs for healing. Different parts of our bodies are more sensitive than others. The tip of the tongue and the fingertips are the most sensitive. They protect us from harmful things that we may ingest into our bodies, or fingers to feel and alert danger, sharp, hot, cold, to read Braille. And with your fingertips, you can play a piano, a guitar, or write with a pen, or give a caress of love and affection. Fine-tune sensitivity. Another part of our body is the sole of the foot. It's the least sensitive. It supports our weight. We stomp on it. We squeeze them into dainty high-heeled shoes or teach them to walk on gravels or sow thistles. Another part of our brain and sensitivity is the pain threshold. The cornea of our eye is by far the most painful, and the fingertips being the least. Remember, the fingertips are the most sensitive, but they don't experience the pain as quick. In his book, The Gift of Pain, Dr. Paul Brand, you all heard that name, he worked with lepers. It's a disease of the nervous system, and no one can lose, how one can lose entire limbs, fingertips, or toes because the warning system has been damaged. They can grab something hot. They can get potatoes right out of the fire or turn your meat on the grill with your fingers. You can run a hoe handle until your fingers bleed and you don't feel it. And then infection sets in and those parts have to be amputated. In North America, our typical response to pain is that we take aspirin or ibuprofen at the slightest headache. And we keep moving. I do. Maybe we should go sit under a tree, drink a cold soda, take a nap, and let my boys and Benito finish the work. Benito's a Nicaraguan fellow that works for us. I don't know what they'd think if I did that. I'm getting old, maybe they'd think I was okay. But the approach only deals with the symptoms, not the real problems. We dare not shut off the warning system without first listening to the warning. Pain is not God's mistake. The sensation of pain is a gift, the gift that nobody wants. I'm not saying that all pain is good. It can and does make our life miserable, from crippling arthritis to terminal cancer, shingles, back pain, toothache. Pain can dominate so much that any relief from it would seem like heaven itself. When I break my bones and swallow an aspirin or whatever to dull the pain, gratitude for the pain is not what comes to my mind. Yet at that very moment, pain is alerting my body to danger that immobilizes and anti-affection defenses that come around my wound and force me to refrain from activities that would further complicate my injuries. Suffering gets our attention. The sickness that keeps us in bed forces us to think about our spiritual condition, and it forces us to look at God when we otherwise would just be on our merry way and ignore Him. There are many types of pain, physical, mental, and spiritual, just to name a few. The pain of loneliness is a cruel form of mental anguish. For those who are single and long for companionship, if God has someone for me, then why isn't it happening and why is it taking him so long? It happened to Julia Rhodes, didn't it? Would friendships or even love exist apart from an inbuilt sense of need? It prods us from being mere hermits. Loneliness pries us away from isolation and pushes us toward others and their needs and well-being. I have been lonely. I thought it was bad. I lived alone for a year in the Canadian wilderness. No telephone, sporadic letters from Grace. And I couldn't speak fluent Cree. And I thought that I had it bad. And then I would think of John McCain, the late senator, who spent 7 years in a bamboo cage in Vietnam. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, solitary confinement in Siberia for 8 years. And one day I got a letter while living at Sandy Lake from a POW. And he said, I read in the newsletter that you're living alone. I thought that I would encourage you, and I was so humiliated. C.S. Lewis calls pain the megaphone of God. God whispers in our pleasure, but he speaks in our conscience, and he shouts through our pain like a megaphone. How many of y'all have heard the story of the wild rabbits that moved into the city? Well, I'm going to tell it to you. There was a wild rabbit colony that was living out in the country, and one day the bulldozers and the road graders and the excavators came, and they were building a new road through the rabbit colony, and there wasn't nothing for them to do but to pack their bags and head into the town for a while to stay with their city cousins. And they wandered around town, and they met their cousins. But the first thing they noticed about their cousins, the rabbits in the city, was how huge and beautiful and sleek and shiny their hair was. They had perfect teeth and beautiful claws. And the wild rabbits say, how do y'all live so well? And don't you have to hunt and forage for food? And the tame rabbit said, our food is provided. We get carrots, apples, corn, collard greens. Life is good in the city. Several days later, the wild rabbits noticed that the fattest and sleekest rabbit had disappeared. And it bothered them. And so they asked, well, where's Johnny? Well, Peter Rabbit. Oh, that happens from time to time, they said. But we don't let it interfere with our lives. There is so much good to enjoy. Eventually, the wild rabbits figured out the system where their fat cousins were destined to the slaughterhouse, their final end. In exchange for their posh, comfortable lives, the tame rabbits willingly chose to shut their eyes to the fact of the imminent danger of death. They turned off their pain sensors. We want to be fat, sleek rabbits. And they ended up in the frozen section of rabbits, Piggly Wiggly. So it happened. And so, like the fat rabbits, some people believe the sole purpose of life is to be comfortable, to pursue intimacy, legitimate or otherwise. Gorge yourself with nice food. Enjoy good food and live the good life. That's all there is. But the presence of suffering vastly complicates that lifestyle unless we choose to wear the same blinders that the tame rabbits did. What does the Bible say about pain and suffering, and is God fair? If God is in charge, How can he allow or seem to be aloof to all the world's suffering? Bad things do happen to good people. How would you have liked to have been, had a dad named Achan? Joshua 7. Why the children? What did they do? Are you to bear the punishment of your father's sins? Moses in Numbers 20. I mean, can't God take a little mistake? You know, in my opinion, it was. I mean, can't God overlook that? He struck the rock instead of spoke to it. I mean, I personally have done a lot worse things than that. You got 40 years of hard work and couldn't go to heaven, couldn't go to Canaan. That's the thanks he got from God. Okay, now, I'm just saying how Moses may have felt. I'm not saying that's how it really was. Well, Jonathan, 1 Samuel 31, and then 2 Samuel 1 talks about Jonathan, the king's own son, who would be the heir of the throne of Israel. And he pours his life into David's success. No doubt he thought he might be a prominent cabinet member in his administration, but he was taken out by a Philistine arrow. Doesn't God care about Jonathan? Jonathan was faithful and loving to the end. Job, he's my hero. His response to unbearable pain and suffering in this life, though he slay me, I will trust him. And you know how the story goes that raiders came and fire and bandits and tornadoes trashed his ranch and robbed him of his family and possessions. And he says this when his wife started to scoff him. He said, "Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" In all of this, Job did not charge God with wrongdoing. It appears that in the Old Testament, suffering was associated with God's punishment. Although the Bible supports the general principle of sowing and reaping, we must not always apply that to one particular person. Nobody deserves suffering like Job, yet few have suffered more. In the New Testament, Jesus points out in John 9 that pain and suffering have many causes, and we have the example of the blind man. And the verse says, "Neither he nor his parents sinned, but this happened so that the work of God might be displayed in his life." And it's hard for us to see that on this side of heaven. Oh, I lost my place here. Oh, the message coming through all of Scripture is not an answer to why people suffer, but more, what are we here for? We are not here just to satisfy our desires, to pursue health, liberty, and happiness. We are here to be changed, to be like Him as He prepares us for a life of service to Him. And sometimes a background of pain and suffering may produce something of value in our lives. In history, the error of associating suffering with God's punishment has far-reaching consequences. In the Middle Ages, the church fathers burned a woman at the stake for taking a pain-relieving medicine during childbirth. They quoted the verse, "In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children." And then we have the first anti-vaxxer, Edward Jenner, who invented the smallpox vaccine. The priest felt that he interfered with God's will, and he was imprisoned. Grace had a sister, Anita. She looked like Grace, had a similar personality, and I made the mistake of patting the wrong girl in the tush one time, and boy, did I ever get a surprise out of her. But in 1982, at the age of 16. She was diagnosed with a type of bone cancer in her spine. The beginning of a painful but relatively short journey that ended in death in several months later. She got much of her treatment in Winnipeg, Manitoba, but at the time, a Jewish rabbi, Mr. Harold Kushner from Winnipeg, wrote a book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. It was an instant bestseller. His young son had progeria, and as he watched the boy grow bald, old, wrinkled, and weak, and finally died, his conclusion in the book was, yes, God does care. God hates suffering, pain, and sickness. He's just simply not powerful enough to do anything about it. God is a God of justice, but he's not a God of power. God really does desire, but cannot help. But we know that God isn't that way at all. God didn't come to Job, I'm sorry about what's happening here. I hope you realize I had nothing to do with how things turned out. I wish I could help you, Job, but I really can't. But God talks to Job and he explains his power in chapter 38 through 41. The creation, the animals, the snowstorms, the constellations. God is in control and has more than ample power. Who said that life is fair? Outlook and attitude does matter. Some of the most miserable and pathetic people on earth are those who, in the midst of calamity and adversity, indulge themselves by wallowing in self-pity and bitterness. All the while, they can sort of delight in blaming God for their problems. Grace's mother, Grandma Mary Jane, obeyed the call to missions as a young bride and moved to northwestern Ontario. She raised her family many hundreds of miles away from uncles, aunts, cousins, parents, and grandparents. She buried her 16-year-old young daughter. She lived on a missionary stipend for over 50 years. She buried her firstborn grandson. She fought cancer for 10 years, 6 rounds of chemotherapy, 5 major surgeries and a mastectomy. Endured the tragic death of many that they ministered to. And she told me, life is not fair, but there is a God who loves me and he knows what he wants from her either in life or in death. Yes, she said, I am afraid sometimes. I am disappointed at the doctor's reports and often sick and nauseated and tired. But she says God has been good to her. She would have liked to have traveled and see her children and grandchildren, but that was not to be. Her first 2 great grandbabies showed up at her funeral. She never got to see or hold them. Do you care about the plight of others? Do you do what we can do to be patient, understanding, and caring for those who suffer? I have felt the sting of being misunderstood, accused of faking it, or having sin in my life. It's sometimes easy for those who are normally enjoy good physical or mental health to become calloused and insensitive to those who suffer. I want to read this. I received a letter from a pastor in the Midwest who recorded what happened when meaning begins to unravel. The man suffered an emotional rather than physical, a nervous breakdown, his doctor called it. But really, it was more than a breakdown in meaning. The most painful part was the seeming silence of God. I prayed. I thought to a silent darkness. I have thought a lot about this, and he only seemed silent. The problem was partly my decision and partly the Christian community, partly my depression. For most Christians, I was an embarrassment. Nothing they said dealt with what I endured. One pastor prayed for me in generalities and pieties, and they were utterly unrelated to the situation. They would not feel my pain. Other people just avoided me. Ironically, Job's friends were probably a help to him psychologically. At least they forced out feelings, even the angry ones. Their pronouncements were useless, but they did deal with the question and gave Job the impression that maybe God was around somewhere. No one in the Christian community except my wife helped me even to that degree. I was told by my dad that everybody needs four things in life. Something to do. It gives us meaning and joy and contentment. It's what challenges us to get out of bed in the morning. We need someone to believe in. Relationships that really sustain and build trust and guidance in our life. Number three, we need something to hope for. The things that inspire us to press on in spite of the present circumstances. And number four, we need someone to love. A basic need woven into the fabric of our soul. Most of us have been fortunate enough to have experienced much love at many levels. We've never doubted our place in the hearts and lives of our family and friends. Yet many millions of people go to bed each night without that peaceful confirmation of their own self-worth and value to others. All that the trodden down can do is go on hoping. After every disappointment, they must find fresh reason for hope. Alexander Solzhenitsyn. We all need hope. Study after study, prisoners of war died for no other reason than lost hope. People in the troughs of serious depression die from no hope. Widowers die 40% within 6 months from a broken heart and no hope. Women must be stronger. Do you offer hope to the sick, the sufferer, the poor, the downtrodden? Is your Jesus the Jesus of the middle class North America, or is he the Jesus of those who've lost hope? I had a conversation with a Hispanic route driver from the Southeast Milk, and his parents immigrated to Florida in 1979 to pick oranges and undocumented workers. And they'd go to North Carolina and pick tobacco. And he went to school and was abused and mistreated because he was Hispanic, undocumented. And I asked him, he was in animal health and sales, and he would come by our farm every month, an amazing young man, devout Catholic, and we'd talk about spiritual things, but he was pretty sold on being on Catholicism. And I said, do you feel oppression? Do you feel your ethnicity is a matter on the farms that you visit? And he says, there's one farm that I visit where they look down on me and they don't value me as an equal. And it was a Mennonite farm. It wasn't in my community, thank God. He gave my brethren a good grade. Someone had given him hope. Will he want my Jesus? Hope deferred makes the heart sick, but a longing fulfilled is a tree of life. Proverbs 13. Sometimes well-meaning people give false hope or a wrong interpretation of God's promises. False hope can lead to a very devastating end. And then when others don't understand. Hebrews 13:3, remember those who are suffering as though you are suffering with them. Many cancer patients say that they feel lavished with love, care, and attention the first time. But when the cancer reoccurs, people back off and seem to be afraid. Sometimes we are afraid, especially when someone we love is suffering. A letter from dear Betsy. Betsy wrote this in a book she wrote just before she passed away from cancer. And she was talking about all the meaningful letters that she got during her illness. And of course, this was before text message. Dear Betsy, I am afraid and embarrassed. And with the problems you are facing, what right do I have to tell you that I'm afraid? I have found one excuse after another for not coming to see you. And with all of my heart, I want to reach out and help you and your family. I want to be available and useful. And most of all, I want to say the words to make you feel well. But the fact remains that I'm afraid, and I have never before written anything like this. I hope you will understand and forgive me. Love, Anne. Anne could not find the personal strength needed to make herself available to her friend. But at least she shared her honest moments and feelings with Betsy and made herself vulnerable. That too is a form of availability. Yes, sometimes we are afraid. Being available. Can we do and make time in our schedules to meet the needs of those who are suffering and hurting? I so often feel inadequate or clumsy in my attempt to reach others. The first years I lived on the First Nations Reserve, one of the church ladies' daughter, a 20-year-old daughter, passed from cancer. I was new. I was young. I was unfamiliar with their culture and customs. But I fired up the wood stove and made bread and took her a hot loaf of bread. That's what white people do. Later, she told me how much she appreciated it, and I felt uncomfortable doing it. Tony Campolo tells of a story of going to a funeral home to pay his respects to a family of an acquaintance, and by mistake, he ended up in the wrong parlor. It held the body of an elderly man, and his widow was the only mourner present, and she seemed so lonely that Campolo decided to stay at the funeral. He even drove the lady to the cemetery. And at the end of the graveside service, he and the woman were driving slowly away. Campolo finally confessed that he had not known her husband. "I thought as much," said the widow. "I didn't recognize you. But that doesn't really matter." She squeezed his arm so hard that it hurt. "You'll never know how much this means to me." And finally, Romans 8:28. In the King James, it says, "And we know that all things work together for good for them that love God, to them that are called according to his promise." I want to tell you this evening, that's just not true. What is good about the death of a young mother and leaving a lot of little children? What is good about wayward children? What is the good about your child being killed by a drunk driver? What is good when your church leader meets an early death? Now let me explain. Many commentators say that this verse has problematic text in the original language. The manuscripts make all things the subject. Others include God as the subject. This is probably a rather broad and general statement after a more specific one concerning the work of the Holy Spirit as our intercessor. And though the cares and difficulty of this life, God's Spirit is there. He's working for our eternal good through the things that are happening in our life, not good in themselves. But God can redeem it for good. And we must accept by faith that God's highest good will come to pass as a result of our suffering. If you read Romans 8:28 in most any other translation, the meaning is this: in spite of the bad things that happen to us, that bad thing is still bad. But in spite of that, God can salvage it for good, for His honor and glory. And so please be careful about quoting that verse at a funeral. When our son was killed, there was 800 people come by. And we heard that verse so often, I wanted to scream. You know, it's been 22 years. I can see other things. But the tragedy was still a tragedy. In spite of that tragedy, God can use it for good. I'm going to finish up here. So what is my response in the path that God leads me on? 2 Corinthians 1. Praise be to God and the Father of our Lord Jesus, the Father of compassion, the God of all comfort, who comforts us in our troubles so that we can comfort those in trouble from the comfort that we ourselves receive from God. For just as the sufferings of Christ flow over into our lives, so also through Christ, our comfort overflows. So when people's children get killed, who do they call? They call us. When people have mental illness and they have to look up to see the bottom, they call me. It's not the ministry you would sign up for. It's what God. In the almost 22 years since Gideon's death, we have felt called to show the compassion of Christ to those who have lost children by an untimely death, to those who struggle from the torment of emotional and mental illness. It is not the role that we would have chosen, not by 100,000 miles, but it is not up to us to choose. The decision is up to God, in that we must trust His judgment for the path that He leads our family on. May God bless you.